Welcome, everyone, to Citizens Climate University. First up tonight, we'll have Rick Knight. Rick Knight is a CCL group leader up in the Illinois area and one of the state co-coordinators, as well as a chapter leader for the Chicago Southwest. Rick's worked for 40 years on a wide variety of energy and environmental R&D projects at the Gas Technology Institute and managed projects with federal contracts up to $20 million. So he's a very level-headed and business-savvy engineer who's now a full-time volunteer after retiring with CCL, and we're lucky to have him and his science-minded communication. Rick, thanks for being on the line. Our learning goals for the first half, they're really threefold. They're going to be focusing on understanding what the science of weather attribution is and who is doing it, and then describing the process for how it is done and what it has found already. And then really, Rick's going to highlight some effective communication tips on how we as Citizens Climate Lobby volunteers can use this information. And the agenda for how we're going to get that actually accomplished is pretty much a straightforward five-part process and then time for Q&A. He's going to talk about what is science attribution, who's doing it, how it's done, what have we found with that process, what good is it, can it be trusted, and then actually opening it up for more of a discussion. So with that, Rick, I'll pass it to you, and thank you again for being on the call tonight.
Thank you, Brett. So anytime an extreme weather event happens, scientists are asked what the role of climate change is. Often this is often framed as, did global warming cause event X, or can we blame X on global warming? This makes scientists uncomfortable because it doesn't fit with their complex and nuanced understanding. And so when asked, did global warming cause this to happen, they generally say, no, but, followed by complex and nuanced verbiage that the questioner doesn't understand. Well, this may be changing because there's a new subdiscipline of climatology called attribution science, wherein some rigor is applied to framing the answers to these questions. So first of all, what are we talking about when we say extreme weather? Well, here are the things that mostly constitute weather: heat, drought, cold, precipitation, wind. And these things are connected to each other in complex ways. For example, heat in the ocean feeds energy to a tropical storm, which can become a hurricane. And if it makes landfall, it can cause devastation through wind and precipitation. There are also secondary effects that we associate with weather, like flooding after a big storm or from sea level rise combined with a storm, or wildfires, which are made more likely by heat and drought and exacerbated by wind. There are other ways that weather elements can be combined, but the question for today is, how is global warming, caused by the buildup of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, connected to these events? So that's why we're now looking at attribution science, the process of quantifying the contribution of global warming to weather events. Okay, so let's start with the definition. This is from a 2010 paper by some Scottish and Canadian scientists. Attribution is defined as the process of evaluating the relative contributions of multiple causal factors to a change or event with an assignment of statistical confidence. And I tried to highlight what I think are the key words, stressing again that for an individual event, global warming is always one of multiple causal factors. And also that we must demonstrate that attribution is not opinion, but the outcome of rigorous analysis backed up by both science and data. So let me translate into plainer language. Weather events are born from many factors, of which global warming is one. Did it make the event more likely? Did it make it more severe? And if so, how much? That's what attribution science tries to answer. So next, who is doing it? Here are three prominent sources. First, the American Meteorological Society, or AMS. They published some attribution studies in their bulletin of the AMS, or BAMS. They publish a special report on this topic each December for the prior calendar year. And second, there's a collaboration called the World Weather Attribution Project, which is coordinated by Climate Central, Their partners include an institute at Oxford, the Royal Netherlands Meteorological Institute, the University of Melbourne, and the Red Cross Red Crescent Climate Center. And third, attribution work is pulled together, sorry, I forgot to put those up, by the National Academy of Sciences and published by the National Academies Press. Now, last year they published a book that I'll tell you about in the next slide. So here are the references for these sources that I used for this presentation. The AMS Special Report, Explaining Extreme Events of 2015 from a Climate Perspective. Well, that's a collection of very technical papers, but they cover many individual events in detail. The Climate Central team doesn't publish printed reports, but they post very thorough analyses of individual events on their website. And here's that National Academies book I mentioned, Attribution of Extreme Weather Events in the Context of Climate Change. You can buy this as a soft cover book, but also can download it as a free PDF. Contributors include scientists from all over the world, and it was chaired by our own CCL Advisory Board member, Admiral David Titley, formerly with NOAA. This book focuses on methodologies and, very importantly, addresses issues of framing when talking about attribution. And here are the links, which we can send you if you request them. And finally, there's a really good write-up about attribution science on the climate.gov website operated by NOAA. Yes, it still exists. I'm not crazy about the title with this business about the blame game, but it really is a good article by the site's managing editor, this Rebecca Lindsay. So next, how is it done? The two major elements are observation of extreme events in the past, using historical data as much as possible, and simulation, using established scientific laws to calculate all the interactions and feedbacks, linking the past, present, and future. The key things that fall under observation are changes in frequency of events and changes in their characteristics, such as temperature, rainfall, duration, and so on. Simulations are different. Now, instead of tabulating observed data, they seek to predict outcomes based on the underlying physics and chemistry, and they simulate the interconnections by use of supercomputer modeling. And these two methods must complement each other. Neither one is sufficient by itself. Observation and simulation are used to generate qualitative or quantitative metrics, like fraction of attributable risk, or FAR. It's a way they often express what is the percent chance that the event will exceed some threshold, and how much of that was the result of global warming. For example, you could say something like, there was a 20% likelihood this drought would not have occurred without global warming. Now, this method turns out to be okay for some types of events, but not so great for others. The other method is risk ratio, which is sometimes called probability ratio. And that's the ratio of the risk to pass up some threshold with global warming compared to the risk without it. So you might say, global warming increased the risk of a drought of this severity by 20%. Now, these methods may sound the same or similar, but they're mathematically different. It turns out that risk ratio has much wider application, but it lacks the causation framing that you can get from FAR. And I think this may become a little clearer when I give you some examples. One more distinction I want to talk about, the difference between unconditional and conditional attribution. These words refer to the type of modeling that's used to quantify it. In an unconditional analysis, all of the climate-related numbers like air temperature, ocean temperature, wind speed, and so on, are calculated by the model based on some initial conditions. So let's say you start with the baseline actual historical global conditions on January 1 of 1950. And then you run your model to see what it tells you to expect from mid-Atlantic hurricanes over all the years up to the present. You run it with and without greenhouse gas buildup, and then you compare that with what has actually happened. Now, in conditional modeling, on the other hand, you would fix certain key parameters like sea surface temperature at the point where a hurricane is just being born, for example. And then you run the model with and without the anomalies along the storm's path. And then you see what the results are for the storm size and intensity. So both of these could be used in attribution studies to answer different questions. Now, so what have researchers found so far? And let's look at some examples and how they relate to things I've talked about. Here's an example from a paper that was pre-published in September of 2016 and then peer-reviewed for final publication in February of 2017. It analyzed a deluge in Louisiana in August of 2016. You might remember that from the news. They used the unconditional modeling approach with data going all the way back to 1860 and then ran six different models. One, two, three, four, five, six. The left-hand chart shows the change in probability of the event based on the risk ratio metric I talked about. And the right-hand chart shows the change in intensity, meaning in this case, the total rainfall. They also computed a weighted average of these models, and that's what the green dotted lines show here. The averaged risk ratio on the left here was 1.4, which means that global warming increased the probability of such a flood by 40%, and the intensity increase over here on the right averaged out to 10%. So now these charts are a bit wonky, so let me show you how it was presented by NOAA on their website. Makes it a lot clearer to non-scientists. It shows on the left how the risk increased from global warming since 1900 in two ways. The average number of years between such events and that 40% increase risk, which are really two sides of the same coin, expressed in different ways. And on the right, how the amount of rain in a typical three-day heavy rain event went up by 10% since 1900. And keep in mind that most of this change has occurred in the last few decades and has accelerated. Here's another example from Climate Central. It involves a very blazing hot summer in southern and central Europe earlier this year. The researchers ran four unconditional models to determine the change in probability of such a summer compared to the probability in 1900. Wait till you see these results. Here are the results in terms of risk ratio, average, and the spreads for the four models they tested, plus a composite average down here at the bottom, the magenta bar. And that average came to about 500. What does that mean? It means that a summer like this is 500 times more likely than it was in 1900. Expressed another way, in a world without global warming, such a summer would be only 0.02% likely to occur in Europe, virtually zero. But in the current world, it's 12% likely. And as global temperatures go up, so does that probability. So fitting the model to data from 1900 to 2017 allows a projection into the future because the model fits the data. Now, these two examples dealt with rainfall and heat, but what about the thing on everybody's minds this past year, hurricanes, or more broadly, tropical cyclones? What can attribution say about those? Because individual storms are such localized events, modeling tools are better suited for analyzing a cyclone season. And that's my next example. Now, instead of the familiar cyclone or hurricane categories we're used to, those categories 1 through 5, scientists have a more meaningful metric called the cyclone energy score, which takes into account not only the wind speed, but also the size and the duration of a storm. 2015 was a brutal year for North Pacific cyclones, not in the Atlantic where we're used to hearing about them, but North Pacific. NOAA scientists analyzed modeled data on North Pacific cyclone season energy score going back to 1940 and then projected forward to 2050. So you can see how the shape of this curve changes, and you'll see what that means. Here, this 99th percentile line represents the actual data from 2015, and the light blue area is the risk of exceeding that total energy. You can see it better if we magnify that area, which the authors also did. It means that the chance of a wicked cyclone season like 2015 or worse will be 5 times higher in 2050 than it was in 1940. But of course, we'd like to know, as I hinted earlier, how much an individual storm is affected by climate change. And that requires a condition model, and I'll show you that next. 2005, as you remember, brought us the deadliest hurricane of this century, Katrina. Now, a team from Virginia Tech, NOAA, and the Army Corps of Engineers studied how the flood levels from Katrina would have differed had it occurred in 1900. They considered global sea level rise, local subsidence, and loss of wetlands, which is also due in part to sea level rise, and storm intensity. So on the left is the effect only of global sea level rise, which accounts for about 1 meter of flooding rise, not counting the local effect. But on the right here, they also included the local changes in sea level, which created between 2 and 3 meters higher flooding in the hardest hit areas, shown here in red. In terms of FAR numbers, the fraction of attributable risk, they said flooding would have been 15 to 60% lower without the impact of climate change. So think of that in terms of the people that got hit and many got killed by this hurricane. Now, just one more, because it's about one of those secondary effects that is much trickier to attribute: wildfires. To be exact, it's an analysis of the 2015 Alaska fire season, which was one of the worst in its history in terms of acres burned. The metric they use is buildup index, or BUI, and that's a measure of fuel availability and flammability. Now, of course, fires are not only a consequence of the amount of deadwood, but of things that cause it to ignite. But still, the Canadians use BUI as a pretty accurate measure of fire risk. So this research team modeled BUI conditions in Alaska back to 1979 and ran their model forward to 2045, beyond this chart. This is the actual observed data. And instead of risk ratio, they used the FAR method. And here's what they found. They concluded that they could attribute between 34 and 60% of current Alaskan wildfire risk to global warming. So these are a few examples of where things stand right now. The National Academies does a good job of explaining how attribution is done. The AMS and Climate Central reports on details of studies that are published. And the climate.gov website gives you a good overview of the science if you want to go and consult that. So now, this is all very interesting, but what good is it to us? How can CCL use this knowledge both now and in the future? A lot depends on the audience. It could be in a lobby meeting or in a presentation or at a tabling event, but regardless, I think there are some important do's and don'ts. 2 points are made clearly on page 44 of that National Academies book. The notion that an event may not have been affected by climate change can be difficult to justify in a climate system in which everything is connected. In any extreme event, multiple contributing factors are involved, both human-induced and natural. Let me focus on the first sentence first. I think we can rephrase this simply in the following way. Every weather event, extreme or not, is affected in some way by climate change. And as long as we keep emitting greenhouse gases, that contribution will keep going up. Then let's take a look at the second sentence. In any extreme event, multiple contributing factors are involved, both human-induced and natural. When confronted with the fallacy of cause and blame framing, such as, did climate change cause this event, or are you trying to blame this on climate change? The way I would paraphrase it is to say, no weather event ever has a single cause. There are always multiple factors, and one of them is global warming. And as long as emissions keep going up, natural factors average out over time, but global warming is different. As long as the emissions keep going up, so will their contribution to extreme weather. It's important that none of these statements are in conflict with the science. Some other framing recommendations related to attribution science. Although attribution's findings are rightly expressed in statistical terms, they're hard for non-scientists to wrap their heads around, or even many scientists if you don't have a good mathematical background. Basic scientific principles are more straightforward. So whenever possible, emphasize science over statistics. And what I mean by that is before citing probability-based results, saying 40% this and 18 to 20% that, it's best to say something about the scientific basis for that connection. So for example, when talking about a heavy downpour, remind your audience that global warming puts more water vapor into the air. Familiarize yourself with the underlying science for various event types, like the example I just gave. And when talking about drought, for example, higher temperatures drive moisture out of the soil. Warmer oceans feed energy into hurricanes. Long hot spells dry out vegetation, supplying fuel for wildfires, and so on. Get to know some benchmark examples of attribution for various types, like heat waves, downpours, floods, droughts, cyclones, and so on. This will help you address questions about similar events, even if they have not yet been thoroughly studied. Many of these can be found on Climate Central's World Weather Attribution page. And don't say no when you mean we don't know yet. What does that mean? It applies to attribution that has not been done and something called the null hypothesis that scientists often rely on. And I don't have time to go into that today, but essentially it's where they say no because they can't say for sure. Don't say no when we don't know yet. So in short, when asked about a recent event, until a formal attribution study has been done, the answer about a possible connection to global warming is we don't know yet. I think that's all I have. I'll turn it back over to Brett.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for being on the call, everyone, tonight. And again, we'll just elevate again the wonderful work, Rick, that you've done to highlight such a complex and incredibly complicated topic that has a lot of moving parts into, I think, a really distilled version for all of us lay people out here in order to communicate it.